Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. She is one of my good friends and one of the most brilliant minds in all of the macro world. She really needs no introduction, but for those of you who don't know, this is Lynn Alden. Lynn, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks for having me back. Always glad to be here.
Okay, so first, I want to get into kind of the inflation, disinflation, transitory debate, because I know that you've given that a ton of thought and you do way more research than anyone other than maybe Jeff Snyder. But before we get there, I'd like to kind of get your view on the world today and what you find most interesting. Like, what have you been thinking about specifically over the last couple of weeks?
Well, specifically longer term, I'm kind of watching certain dynamics. So one is energy. That's been a big theme of mine for a while now. That kind of ties into the whole inflation versus deflation debate, but it's also important as its own subject. Also watching the ongoing kind of digital transformation of financial systems, right? So how will things like Bitcoin or stable coins over time change the way our system's structured, as well as central bank digital currencies, right? So all these different directions that those can take over the coming years. So I think those are some of the bigger themes I'm watching. But a lot of it comes down to the whole, you know, the whole inflation versus deflation, financial repression, fiscal policy, monetary policy, that sort of thing as well.
So as far as the cryptocurrencies, let's focus on Bitcoin. I think the price isn't really the most interesting thing about the cryptocurrency itself. How do you see that reshaping finance? And then I think maybe a more important question is, how do you see that reshaping the real economy and allowing us to create more goods and services? How does that make us more productive in the real economy, or does it?
Well, I mean, so the short version is that the financial system is kind of working the same way that it has for decades, right? So it slowly upgrades over time, of course, right? You might have a mobile app, for example, to go with your bank. So they do adjust around the margins. But for the most part, the actual underlying pipes are unchanged for decades. And that has implications for the euro dollar market, the way international trade happens, as well as what people are able to store their money in. And so Bitcoin essentially represents another asset that is, you know, basically self-custodied, that, you know, has enough fungibility and liquidity to be considered, you know, essentially a currency or money. And so in some sense, it's like a digital gold, but with other attributes as well. And so it basically represents a new way to do international payments as well as a reserve asset. Of course, it's still smaller and volatile. So it's kind of on that path, and we're going to see how far it gets along that path. So that's one thing. And then two, with the introduction of Bitcoin, of course, you know, people looked at the underlying technology and said, how can we repurpose this? So ever since at least 2014 or so, China began researching central bank digital currencies. So they basically, right, you know, if anything, take some of the attributes of Bitcoin and then reverse all of those attributes while still having some of the you know, kind of like the concepts in place. And so they've gone that route. And of course, in other markets, there are private stable coins that have done similar things, you know, but of course, with a different approach. And I think over time, we're probably going to see stable coins get more and more embedded in the financial system. I think that can replace some of their rails over time. You know, most people that do stable coins for, say, international payments, they kind of, you know, are in that space. They kind of say, if you're not bearish on that, if you're not bullish enough on that space, go try to do an international wire transfer, right? It's like, it kind of shows how sluggish the old system can be. Sometimes you don't even know which bank held up your transfer, and you're kind of, both banks are blaming each other. Whereas stable coins, it's all, you know, it's pretty much directly there. Now, it's not the same thing as Bitcoin. It's not as decentralized as Bitcoin. But it's basically a digital layer that makes everything go a lot faster. So I think longer term is that we're going to see less payment friction over time as more of these technologies develop, and less payment friction is good for the economy. We already see that in some ways. And within a specific country, you can have kind of these efficient payment systems, but we don't really have efficient international payments. And we don't have, you know, these kind of more permissionless types of payments.
Yeah, I agree. I think it'll move the needle, but I don't know if it'll move the needle to a significant degree. I'm just thinking about the last time I did actually tried to execute what you're referring to as far as an international wire payment. And that's when I took dollars from the United States and brought them down to Colombia. So I had to execute the wire, let's say with Wells Fargo, and then it goes to an intermediary bank, and then it gets down to the what is basically a brokerage account at Alianza. Then I have to buy and give them the green light. They have to buy the pesos with the dollars, and it's this deal that takes probably 2 or 3 days, something like that. But if it were to take 2 or 3 seconds, it would be far better, that's for sure. But I don't know that I would take that, because let's say that money is used to buy an apartment. I've got to remodel the apartment and improve it and create a service in the real economy, create shelter or for someone. It would shave a couple days off the whole process, which is good, but I don't know that that helps me create more apartments or more living spaces, more shelters long term.
Well, I think it depends on where you live in the world. And so, for example, I think it's one of those things where it starts more at the bottom in that sense. And so, for example, remittance payments are a big area where I think it can change quite a bit, because right now, sending a small international payment, you end up losing a big percent of it to fees. Whereas if you send a very large payment, you lose a smaller percentage. You might pay a more higher dollar amount, but you lose a small percentage. So I think one area is remittance payments. And two, you know, for example, I know that Guardian ran a piece back in the summer talking about, say, Bitcoin in Nigeria. It has pretty high adoption there. And of course, they have more currency problems and various controls like that. And basically, there were, for example, protests occurring against police violence and other matters, and protesters would have their bank accounts frozen, so they would start to use Bitcoin and go around that problem. In addition, because of some of the capital controls, there were like merchants, small merchants that say buy some of the raw materials overseas, and they were blocked from doing that. And they said, well, wait a second, I can just use some of my Bitcoin to do that. Right. And so that's an example, and that can also potentially be done with certain stable coins and things like that. So there are a few different ways to do that. But I think that's going to become more meaningful over time, especially for some markets. And now we know that, you know, emerging markets actually represent the majority of global GDP and population and kind of the marginal growth. And so that's kind of when we look in the global sense, it's important to keep in mind, whereas people that already have fairly reliable payment systems are maybe less impacted. I think for people in developed markets, perhaps the biggest story is to see if any of these can become a more stable store of value, like Bitcoin, for example. Right, now, it's you know, it's obviously still very volatile. It went up from zero to $1 trillion market capitalization. And then the question is, can it become $5 trillion? Can it become as big as gold? Can it, you know, how large is the total adjustable market of this? So one thing I would phrase is that essentially over the past, especially over the past 10 years, but really over the past, you know, 40 years, you know, basically for lack of good money, we've monetized other things. So rather than storing up money in say cash and bonds, we go out and we buy, you know, extra real estate. We plow it into the S&P 500. You know, we monetize all these other things, even fine art, for example, right? We'd rather pay, you know, $200 million for a painting than hold cash and take on all that risk of that particular asset because, you know, the money's been so, you know, problematic with the yields below the inflation rate, you know, below the money supply growth rate. And so in that environment, there's a tendency to speculate and monetize another thing. So if you were to get, you know, more countries able to basically access something that is you know considered harder money, that can demonetize some of those other assets. So I think it's a trend to watch over time.
How would that differ from gold?
Well, the main difference between gold is that it's more mobile, right? So gold that goes back to
but as far as the countries using it as a store of value.
Well, I think it depends how much they want. And so, for example, if you look back over the past few decades, there hasn't been until around the global financial crisis, there was this trend of them not really going into gold, going into sovereign bonds. And the problem is that's where we bring up, say, the long-term debt cycle. And we point out that, you know, that might have worked for 30, 40 years. But now with debt levels so high and interest rates below the inflation rate, you know, they can lose money on their sovereign bond holdings if they want, have fun with that, right? And it's not going to, you know, it's going to keep happening. Or you have countries like Russia that are buying gold. I mean, some emerging market central banks are still buying gold. I think Russia's about 20% of their reserves are gold. So it's mostly euro-denominated assets, and then they have a sizable gold allocation. Bitcoin is still too small and volatile for most central banks to really kind of put any serious capital in. But if it were to get bigger, that's another option. In addition, one of the kind of unique things it has is that it's also a means of payment. And so you can see around the periphery, right? If North Korea or Iran, for example, want to be able to make international payments, they unfortunately have the kind of incentive to go to that first, right? It's kind of like how when beepers came out, they were heavily used by criminals. Even though, of course, they had a legitimate use by doctors and lawyers and other kind of time-sensitive professions, but criminals also made use of them. And so you see, for example, that you know, countries that are kind of cut off from the system find that secure, permissionless international payments are actually useful, and they can store up, you know, energy in that system so that they have kind of a stockpile of, you know, international payment potential if they need it. And so it's kind of like gold plus that international payment system. But right now, of course, because it's, you know, roughly a tenth of the size of gold and it's far more volatile, it's a different asset profile overall.
Yeah. And just for the listener's clarification, probably the most confusing thing you've said in this whole interview, Lynn, is beepers. And those were pagers, for those of you who don't know. For those of you who are under the age of 30, we actually had these things that we wore on our belt. When someone would give you a phone call, it would page you. So you could go to the phone and then call that person right back with their phone number. So just a little flashback with technological history there. So how does Bitcoin get less volatile? How do we go from A to B there?
I think there are a couple of ways. One is that it has to have higher adoption, right? So you know, even though there's statistics showing that maybe over 100 million people own it, for most of those people, it's a very small percentage of their net worth, and they treat it like a very risky asset because it has been a very volatile asset. And so if it were to continue its adoption curve and be held by more people, that any individual person or any individual kind of, you know, cohort of people have less ability to move it. In addition, as it reaches that higher adoption, maybe higher price level, higher market cap, the growth generally slows down at some point. We saw, for example, that over the past, you know, almost 13 years of Bitcoin's operation, it has gradually decelerated. So, for example, the peak in, say, 2013 compared to the peak in 2011 was like a 50-fold increase in price.
The vol's decreased, right?
Yeah, and then you look at, say, the 2017 to 2013 peak, that was like a 20-fold increase. And so it's still tremendous, but it is decelerating from a very small base, kind of like how if you start from a micro cap stock and then you grow and you become a larger share of the market, you start running into the law of large numbers. So I still think the total adjustable market is very large, but eventually as it gets closer to whatever that kind of percentage of global assets that it's maybe gonna find some stability around, that becomes less speculative, attractive for speculators. Yeah. So one of the contributors of volatility, in addition to the relatively low adoption, is the leveraged offshore exchanges, where, you know, when you think it's going to pump, they leverage it up fivefold, and then when it goes down, they get liquidated and they contribute to that volatility, both in the upside and the downside. Mm-hmm. And so you'd expect over time for that to normalize a little bit as it becomes a less speculative asset. So volatility can kind of feed on itself to the upside, but then also it kind of dissipates to the downside over time.
Yeah, it is interesting how that demand may shift, or the main motivation for demand shifts from speculation to a more broad use case as volatility goes down.
Yeah, and we've even seen, for example, this year, Bitcoin was preferred by institutions. They have more regulatory clarity on it, in a sense that they know it's not a security, it's a commodity. It doesn't pass the Howey test. And in addition, it's the one that's, you know, truly decentralized. Whereas, you know, retail in many ways flooded into the altcoin market because they're the ones that were starting from a smaller base and they're more speculative. Right. Now, there's a really poor track record of altcoins of getting to the next cycle with new highs, right? So Bitcoin is the one that's able to do that. Ethereum was able to do that from the last cycle. Most altcoins out of the thousands that exist don't really make it to the next cycle and kind of, you know, keep building on their prior, you know, speculative highs. So it's kind of a low probability bet playing off, but you see retail going into that. It's kind of like if you really want speculation, that's where it is. Whereas you see Bitcoin shifting more towards people that are dollar cost averaging into it, treating it as insurance that they hold outside of the system. kind of regardless of price, kind of price insensitive holders. And then you have institutions wanting to get in and have a small percentage of their capital in it. So we have seen kind of a differentiation in the market. And it just, I think it needs more time and more adoption.
Yeah, right. So I ask a lot of people this question. I say, if you had to bet your entire net worth as to what will still exist in 100 years, gold or Bitcoin, what would you say?
Well, I think at this stage, I mean, gold's the one you know won't go to zero, right? Yeah. So there, I can imagine tail risks for Bitcoin. I think, for example, that Bitcoin will probably be higher than gold. You know, it'll have returned more value, more purchasing power than gold over the next 10, 20 years. The further you look out, though, you know, there's obviously risk. We're talking about a 13-year-old asset compared to, you know, a 5,000-year-old asset, or, you know, really an asset that's as old as the sun. And so, you know, those are two different things. I would also say, you know, a key risk I would have with gold is that we are seeing that there is this increased interest, especially among younger investors, into, say, Bitcoin and other assets. And so I'd be somewhat concerned about holding gold on its own for that sense. I basically think a gold plus Bitcoin allocation is actually in some ways safer than just gold. And I know the guys over at Incrementum, you know, I think they have that fund that's like, say, mostly gold, and then it has a slice of Bitcoin in it. They're the ones that published the In Gold We Trust report.
Yeah, Ronnie.
Ronnie and his partner, and they've adopted, I think, well to Bitcoin while still being bullish on gold, and they kind of use those as diversification and risk management. And so that's kind of how I would approach that if I was, from a gold investor standpoint. And I think also you can say, okay, you know, my approach anyway is that I want to be exposed to multiple things that I consider finite. So when I often talk about commodity exposure. And gold is on its own beat compared to many other, you know, say, industrial commodities. They don't necessarily go up and down at the same time. And also, you can have specific issues in one commodity that might suppress it. So I like to go gold, silver, copper, energy, Bitcoin. I like to kind of spread my bets around a little bit in terms of things that I expect to hold on to their value for, you know, say, a 10-year period.
Yeah, I think what Ronnie's doing is really smart. That seems to be a very prudent approach. I've never understood why people would want to choose gold or Bitcoin and not choose both to a certain degree based on what your objectives were and your age and your income and whatnot. That always seems to make the most sense. And I think especially in today's world, you know, like we were saying earlier, the price of Bitcoin is in my opinion, the least interesting thing, just because this push towards authoritarianism. And who knows if you might need to have some sort of purchasing power that's outside of the banking system moving forward. And even if Bitcoin, you know, goes down in price by 20 or 30%, who cares? At that point in time, you'd be very glad that you had that asset or that purchasing power that was outside of the commercial banks.
There are even interesting technologies that are building on Bitcoin in terms of sending data. And so the Impervious AI is kind of considered like a third layer on top of Bitcoin. It runs on top of the Lightning Network. And so now you can do, say, peer-to-peer messaging, phone calls over Lightning. And basically they're using the Satoshis going on the Lightning, and you basically have a virtual VPN, like a VPN over Lightning. And so it's kind of an extra layer of security. And so there are, the broader term in the crypto space would be Web 3.0, right? The idea that basically there's a more decentralized things. You know, some of the challenges there is that some of those underlying protocols themselves are somewhat centralized. And so they can still be disabled. They have attack services that the state go after some. And so basically on Bitcoin, you see maybe less proliferation, but the ones that are being built, I think, are a little bit more robust. And so I think there are kind of these technologies that are building. And again, that's like to your point, that's not about Bitcoin's price. That's just something that's interesting to watch. And that, you know, I believe that they're coming out with a browser as well. And so you see over time, I think we're going to have more technologies that you know, try to go around the existing kind of centralized forces that make up, say, the internet and the financial system. And you see them kind of moving around towards the edges and towards this more open source distributed type of situation.
Okay, so let's go from something that's rather complex to something that's a little easier to understand, and that would be energy, just kind of more supply and demand there. I think what I've been paying attention to is really China and Evergrande with their real estate market crashing. And I listened to my good buddy Jason Burke, his interview with Kyle Bass, which was fascinating. I think that came out yesterday. And Kyle was describing how he saw China playing out in the future. But such a large component of their GDP is real estate. And if Xi Jinping allows that to continue to decline, to kind of have this soft landing and deflate that bubble, I see that as being very negative, possibly in the short term, for commodities such as iron ore. So how do you see that?
Yeah, so I agree. I'm not particularly bullish on iron ore itself. As for energy, I've separated the time frames. I tweeted a few weeks ago, or it might have been a month ago now, where I was talking about how would it be funny to see Chinese tech stocks start to do well and oil stocks start to struggle, because everyone was so super bearish on China and so super bullish on energy. The sentiment, of course, can get out of whack for periods of time. With energy stocks, it's one of those things where if you zoom in, they looked like overbought to some extent. Everyone's kind of talking cons about the energy crisis in Europe, and then also in China with coal. And so, that I think could be overdone for periods of time. So I wouldn't be surprised if energy markets just don't do very well over 6 months or even a year. My kind of viewpoint is longer term, is saying, okay, 5-10 years out, I think essentially the 2020s are going to be a pretty good decade for energy prices and energy producers. And it's essentially a supply demand issue. And that there are, because, everything's kind of priced around the margin, when there are fluctuations in demand, whether it's Chinese housing or maybe some sort of deflationary shock related to debt in 2022, there are these periods of time where I think it will underperform, but that, you're starting from such a small base. And so, for example, the energy sector reaches all-time low weighting in the S&P 500 last year. It got down to 2%, and it's since rebounded all the way up to 3%. And so it seems like it's overbought, and in the near term it might be, but it's still one of the lowest weightings that it ever was. While also the supply and the demand, I think characteristics, especially on the supply side, are more favorable for it going forward.
How did energy in the commodity space behave in the 1940s?
It did very well. So a general rule of thumb with the inflationary decades and commodity prices is that all the inflationary decades had high commodity inflation as well. It's been kind of an axiom that it's hard to get inflation without high commodity prices. That there have been some periods where you have high commodity prices without necessarily super high official CPI. So you can kind of have the other way around, but all the inflationary periods do come with these higher commodity prices. And essentially, because what you get is an increase in the money supply and then some sort of natural resource constraint. And so you can imagine a hypothetical economy that was entirely consisting of software, right? And so if everybody got more money all of a sudden, that might not necessarily translate into higher prices, because the cost of producing those goods doesn't really change. The marginal cost of selling an additional subscription to a software.
Yeah, your margins are 100% anything. On that. All your costs are fixed.
Exactly. So basically, people might buy more software, but it might not actually affect the prices of that software, or at least not much. Whereas if you have an economy that's really based on labor and commodities, it's really about that resource constraint. And so things can fluctuate from periods of time to see what's tight and what's not. But essentially, especially historically, and I still think that even though we've become somewhat more digital, we're still very reliant on that physical connection to the world, these physical resources, especially in developing markets where they have much lower per capita usage of them. And so as they generally grow over time, even to get up to a fraction of what we use in Europe and the United States, North America, I still think there's a runway of growth ahead there, while many of their supplies are rather constrained.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Art Berman, I think you know Art as well. He's just a great guy, but he's just a specialist in the oil field, and he's a geologist by trade, I believe. And he always says that energy is the economy. And I think as I drive, you know, I don't know if you know this, but last week I did an RV tour where I went to specific campsites and just invited, you know, anyone in the Rebel Capitalist community to come out there, and we did barbecues and I had beer and burgers and hot dogs and all that stuff. But just driving, we did Tucson, El Paso, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio. And just driving my truck out there, you see all the big trucks, you know, hauling goods across the United States. And I see that through the lens of these shortages with the supply chain disruptions and the labor shortages and whatnot. But when you start to notice that stuff as you're driving, you really realize how that's true. You know, the real economy is really revolves around energy. If we don't have that energy, the economic growth has to decline.
Yeah, the massive growth in GDP, including real GDP that we've seen over the past 200 years, has been very tightly correlated to our ability to access those dense forms of energy.
Right,
whether it's coal, oil, and gas, and then nuclear that we kind of abandoned, you know, part of the way. So there are different ways to do it, but essentially our ability to access those much denser forms of energy, we put a little bit of energy in and you get a ton of energy out. That's been pretty essential for that kind of mechanization and industrialization of our world. And it's heavily correlated to GDP growth around the world. And of course, you know, that can go down a little bit over time as economies become a little bit more digital and efficient. But there's also ways, it's funny because there's ways to hide it. And so in a specific country, you can have what seems to be a disconnect between energy usage and GDP, right? So this has been common in the United States and Europe, where energy usage per capita kind of stops going up, but GDP does. But then, for example, if you look and say, okay, well, actually what we did was we outsourced most of our energy intensive production to China and other countries. Right. And so we kind of shifted whose balance sheet.
I wonder if that would correspond with a trade deficit.
Well, to some extent, yeah.
In those countries, you know, those countries that you're referring to?
To some extent. So obviously, like, the U.S. has done that more than, say, Europe and Japan have. But even in Europe and Japan, that still have, say, you know, balanced trade situations, or in many cases, trade surpluses, they still outsource some of the really cheap energy intensive stuff and keep a lot of the precision manufacturing.
Okay.
And so in many ways, you offshore some of that really intense stuff, but it still shows up when you look at global numbers. So even though an individual country can kind of decouple to some extent economy from energy, it's really hard to do that in the worldwide sense.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. It's a fascinating topic, and you know, I just I won't get into great detail here, but I just listened to the recent Macro Voices discussion episode with Jeff Snyder, who's one of our favorites, and he just made some fantastic points about the bond market and how it has almost always predicted the rate of inflation. Either is it transitory or is it something that's more secular? And when I was in the gym this morning, I was kind of thinking through this, and every single point that he was making or every thought I had just really pointed me in the direction of the 1940s. The more I think about that, which has been your idea for, you know, what, 6 months or maybe a year now. And I think that you are just spot on by saying that the 2020s will most likely resemble the 1940s. And what I'm referring to specifically there is, if you look at a chart of inflation in the 1940s, you have these huge spikes. And then, I mean, I think one spike even went up to like 18 or 19%, and then it comes all the way back down to zero. Then you have another huge spike. And then at the end of the 1940s, or right around that time, we actually had significant deflation, where prices as measured by the CPI were down, I think, -2%, -3%. And it's all a result of these government distortions, let's say, with supply shocks, or maybe it was short-term quote-unquote money printing that wasn't sustained long-term. And so you just see these dramatic spikes up and down. Do you want to expand on your views of the 1940s?
Yeah, I view it as being similar to the 40s. And so, when people think about inflationary decades, they often think of the 70s, right? Because you had high inflation, you had high interest rates. But there were a couple of key differences there. One was, that was very much bank loan driven. So there were fiscal deficits as well that kind of compounded that. But you had, money supply was going up because you had both bank lending and you had fiscal spending. And you had, again, a resource constraint. So American oil production peaked in 1970.
But that would be more consistent with the Austrian definition of inflation, and that it isn't necessarily prices going up, but it's more so an expansion of the money supply.
Yeah, you had money supply going up, and then it also translates
because of the prices. Bank lending. I just want to clarify that for the viewer, right?
Well, and then also, Austrians, I think they talk about the increase in the money supply for multiple reasons, right? So in Turkey right now, money supply is going up rapidly. It's not necessarily because of bank lending. It's because you're basically running those fiscal deficits, and that actually goes back to the 40s, where the difference between the 40s and the 70s was that the 70s inflation was very much in large part led by bank lending, whereas the 1940s was. Bank lending was minimal, but the money supply was going up substantially because of fiscal deficits. So basically creating new money in that sense. So not just QE alone, but that QE combined with that fiscal spending that actually got money out of the economy and built things with it, increased the money supply. And the interesting thing about, kind of the inflationary spikes you had in the 40s is, you have 19% year-over-year inflation, which you did briefly. A period of 3% deflation does not, take away those price increases that happened. When you look at it in year-over-year terms, you see these big three inflationary spikes. You see one or two very kind of minor deflationary periods. But when you look at the CPI in absolute terms, essentially what you saw is these plateaus. It would spike up to a new level and then just stop going up, maybe go down a tiny bit, and then it would spike up to another level. And then level off. And so over that 10-year period, prices went up 80 or 90%, and that was just their new high watermark. So CPI went up that far, and then it never came back down. So if people were holding bonds or cash, they just permanently lost purchasing power. And it just wasn't, it didn't just keep compounding into hyperinflation. It eventually stabilized back then. Of course, there are different environments. The United States had a trade surplus back then. And they didn't have the entitlement demographics issues that we have now. So there's a kind of different analog overall. But essentially in that environment, they were able to eventually slow that inflation in large part because they just stopped doing those very large fiscal injections that was causing the inflation because it was different than bank lending.
Yeah.
So you didn't actually claw back all those price increases. Those were now the permanently high levels.
So how would you define the 1940s in today's terms? Because I think a lot of the controversy or going back and forth, a lot of the debate is just in semantics. It's not really in concepts or ideas. I mean, the 1940s, would you consider that transitory inflation or would you consider that secular inflation?
I would consider that secular inflation because you had a permanent increase in the broad money supply and a permanent increase in prices. And that doesn't mean you have a new permanent level of annual inflation, right? So this was the point I was making earlier because this was kind of a question I knew would come up a lot and would confuse, especially a lot of people that don't follow finance closely. Yeah. Is the difference between transitory and rate of change terms and transitory and absolute terms. So transitory and absolute terms would mean that say there's a specific supply bottleneck and prices soar. Let's say a gas line breaks and my state can't get gasoline. And so we have this huge spike in gas prices. It's very localized. And then eventually that gets fixed. And also, people get trucks and they bring over gasoline and people cut down their gasoline usage temporarily until that problem's resolved. And then prices go back down to kind of normalize with the nationwide average. That'd be an example of transitory in absolute terms. We eventually claw back all those price increases. And that can happen on a global scale if you have something like a specific industry gets disrupted. Let's say, the biggest copper mine goes offline from a flood, for example. You have a temporary increase in copper prices until that's resolved. Same thing with autos or things like that. So that can happen. Now, what we saw in the 40s was the different kind of transitory inflation, which is, you had this big permanent increase in prices, but the rate of that annual year-over-year inflation eventually stopped happening. You eventually went back down to low year-over-year inflation.
In the 1950s, early 1950s, right? Yeah, after that deflationary period in the end of the 40s, right?
Yeah, by the time you got to the 50s. And so you no longer had that structural inflation ongoing, but those prices were locked in stone. You know, across the board, you had broad permanent price increases, as well as a broad permanent increase in the money supply as measured by M2 or M3 or different ways to measure it. And so people had more money in their bank account, things cost more, but then they stabilized at that higher level. And so that's why I wouldn't consider that overall to be transitory inflation.
Okay, so I think the takeaway there is people have to consider the supply side of the equation when considering how permanent or not permanent, I guess permanent isn't sustained, let's say, if inflation is going to be sustained, they've got to look at those potential supply shocks, because it sounds like we had those in the 1940s, just like we're having those today.
Yeah, and in the 40s and also the 70s, part of the kind of the temporary halting of inflation, you see these wage and price controls kick in, right? And so if you look at both the 40s and the 70s, inflation was never a straight line. I always joke that, if you imagine if Twitter existed in the 70s or the 40s, and you'd have like the inflationists and the deflationists, they'd be taking turns kind of,
dunking on each other.
Exactly. Because there were these periods where it's like, look at the prices going up. And then it's like, oh, look, now we have negative 1% inflation. Now look, now it's 19%. Yeah. And so I think we're going to, now we're in 2020s, we're going to see that happen in real time where we're going to have this kind of irregular environment. And there are going to be periods of time where it looks like it's transitory and then, oh, maybe it's not. And then, I think we actually saw a little bit of a fake out there where inflation was leveling out for a period of time. And now it's being driven by other things. It's being driven by housing. And so we're kind of getting another leg up in inflation. But that's still kind of a smaller version. If we have, say, let's say there's congressional gridlock in late 2022 from an elections, and let's say fiscal spending dries up or at least, slows down, decelerates, I think you could certainly have a period where inflation kind of levels off and goes down for a period of time. And then it comes down to what the response is going to be in that situation. So I think by no means is this going to be a smooth decade. It's not like this inflation is going to be right for 10 years. I think it's kind of like, I think adding it all together and looking back from the end of the decade, I think we'll have said inflationists were generally right. That's my current base case. It's been my base case for a little while, but I think there will be individual years where they're not right at all.
Yeah, yeah. And just for the average viewer out there, in the 1970s, you had this up and down and up and down and up and down, but you kind of had that up and down between, let's say, 5% and maybe 15%. And what made the 1940s different was those spikes up and down were between 19% and -3.
Yeah.
So kind of a different range there. So without getting into the plumbing of why it happened, just kind of the headline numbers, that's what you're expecting. And kind of that's what I would expect as well. And it's really based on, kind of the government. I said in a discussion I had at Mark Moss's event over the weekend that you have to start answering economic questions by answering political questions first.
Yeah. And you have to do it on the global scale as well. Right. Yeah. So, the United States used to be the major global driver and it's still one of the biggest, but you also have to look at China and Europe to varying degrees. Certainly China can affect iron market, for example. All these different countries based on their fiscal policies and which things they let happen and the timings with which they let them happen influence these things. So I think when things start showing up on popular financial magazine covers is when you have to start really considering, okay, this might still be right in the longer term, but it's not going to be a straight line of the way there. Once everybody is on one side of the boat, turns over, shakes out some of them and it kind of, then it goes through another cycle. And I think that's how we have to approach it.
Yeah. And everyone's on the inflation boat right now. So, to your point, I wouldn't be surprised if, 2022, 2023, we had a CPI print, and even though it's kind of bogus, but that CPI print go back down to 2% and shock everyone. And then the very next year, based on government spending or another supply shock that's created by government distortions in the economy, it goes right back up to 8% or 7%.
Yeah, at the current time, I say we have reasonable transparency out to about 2 quarters. So we pretty much know that housing and rent inflation are probably going to keep the number kind of sticky for a while, right, as officially measured. So if you look at, you know, right, they don't directly include housing prices and CPI anymore. But they include a proxy of owner's equivalent rent, which is kind of an understated and smoother way to measure it. And if you also track, say, official CPI rent increases compared to what actual rents are going up as. If you look at, for example, Invitation Homes, I think they're the biggest single family homeowner in the U.S. They had like something like, 60% rent increases for their new tenants and something like, 7% for their existing tenant. So it averaged to be like 11% rent increases. Right. And we haven't seen that fully in the rent CPI yet. And we haven't seen owner's equivalent rent kind of, keep up in any way with overall housing price increases. And so it looks like we're, it's based on the momentum of what's happening there in CPI. It looks like we still have at least another quarter or two of those kind of, keeping the headline CPI number sticky. But yeah, once we get into mid 2022, that's going to depend on a couple of different factors. What are the fiscal situations in the United States, Europe, and China, and also what's happening, with some of the supply chains, right? That's what I would start to say, that maybe it won't be a straight line, in around that time. But I could certainly update that view based on what happens between now and then.
How do you explain the long end of the curve right now?
Well, I think there's a couple factors. One is that it responds to changes in its expectation of growth. And so you're basically, you get different signs from the market about how much growth will happen over a period of time. And then two, the relationship between central bank buying and yields is kind of messy. It's not as though every time they buy bonds, yields drop. Sometimes you even get the opposite.
The opposite since the GFC.
Often, except for example, if you look at Europe, right? So they had the sovereign bond. Remember the sovereign bond crisis in Europe in like 2012, yields got super high, especially in Southern Europe. And, when we look back and we say, okay, well, why are yields now super low? And it's not because their debt went down. They didn't fix their fiscal situations, right? They're still, many of them have higher debt to GDPs than they have now. They're no less of a credit risk. It's just that the market's understanding is that the ECB is just not going to let spreads blow out, or at least not for a sustained period of time. And so, basically the ECB became the biggest buyer and eventually drove those yields down. So even though there are periods where they stop and then drive them up again, those are signals to the market where sometimes the market will say, okay, now we can go buy stocks because they're doing QE. So they can kind of get out of bonds, go to stocks, yields go up temporarily. But in the grand scheme of things, I think if you zoom out, anytime a country gets over about 80% public debt to GDP, the biggest buyer becomes the central bank. That's without exception through all these countries. And I think, you just have to ask the question, what if they just sold 20% of their bonds? What if they just say, we're not going to do QE, we're going to start selling bonds on the market? I think you'd have this period of time where, especially in countries that are just not monetarily sovereign, where they're actually worried about credit, credit risk in the sovereign market, like you had with Italy and Greece there for periods of time, I think you would see higher yields. So I think it's one of those things where that's where I would say disagree with Jeff on, that I do view us in being in a period of financial repression where yields are going to be below the inflation rate for a period of time because you don't have a supply demand problem in the bond market as long as central banks are willing to kind of take all that excess supply off and then let the bond market price the smaller amount that's still out there, right? So there's still some information of value around the margins for, when bond yields go up sharply or go down sharply. That's the bond market kind of fleshing out different growth and inflation scenarios. But I think the magnitude is going to be several hundred basis points off from inflation most of the time.
Yeah, and I'd like to point out that during those times in the 1940s when we had that 19% inflation rate, the yield on the 10-year was capped at, 2.5%, something like that?
Yeah, long end was capped at 2.5%. The short end was around zero.
Yeah, and they were able to do that back then. So it is messy, to say the least. Yeah,
it's messy. And I mean, another thing is, if you look at, say, this was an argument I was kind of exploring my newsletter in 2020, is we had that period of super low bond yields. Now, they're still low today, but they were even lower in that mid-2020 period. Mm-hmm. And if you looked at a year later, so you've looked at them in mid-2021, many of them already underperformed inflation. So in the sense that, say you looked at 5-year treasuries, the 1 year between 2020 and 2021 already surpassed all the coupon payments you're going to get from a 5-year treasury if you bought it in 2020. So unless you have a period of outright deflation, like if you have zero inflation for the next 4 years, that bond was already wrong about, you know, maintaining its purchasing power. You'd have to have literally deflation on average for the next 4 years in order to claw back some of your lost purchasing power. So, you know, the bond market is not always smart money in that sense. It can and does lose purchasing power. It lost, you know, basically every inflationary decade that going back to, you know, the 1910s, World War One, 1940s, World War Two, 1970s, all three of those decades, bonds lost money on a real basis. Like there were multiple, you know, years where you bought a 10-year treasury, and if you went and held that to maturity, you lost a considerable amount of purchasing power.
Right. Yeah. So it, from a predictive standpoint, there may be something there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's smart money.
Yeah. At least not in terms of looking at these large. Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's certainly, it can be tactical in the near-term sense. It can basically give you signs that something is changing, something is decelerating or accelerating in the economy. But it's not as though they're just immune from having massive losses on a real basis.
Yeah. What did other asset classes do in the 1940s? So I'm curious what the stock market did and the housing market.
So the housing market did great. You know, they came up from very, very low levels. The stock market started to do very good after 1942. So once the United States had a couple decisive victories in the Pacific, and it started to look like, you know, basically the United States was going to be okay. And that this was, you know, there's still kind of a long grind ahead of them, but that it was looking favorable. The market started to do very well. So stocks did well, housing did well, commodities did well, and gold was pegged. So gold was kind of a non-market, but silver did well, for example. And so another caveat, though, that I like to point out is that stocks went into that period very low priced.
You know, I was just going to say that before everyone gets excited, just time out here.
Yeah. So if we go back to the 40s and the 70s, the difference is in the 70s is high inflation and high rates. So that's, of course, bad for equities. Yeah. Because their whole discount rate changes. Plus, some of them have issues with payment timings and things like that surrounding inflation. In the 40s, you know, that was generally a more favorable environment for equities because you didn't have the higher interest rates, and you had that more kind of high nominal GDP growth, high inflation. So that was favorable towards equities. The example that we don't have is what happens if you get a 40 situation, but equities go into it at record high valuations. We don't really have
housing.
So we don't really have that kind of test case. That's the challenging thing. I often point out that even though I think overall the 40s are a much better representation of the 2020s in terms of fiscal monetary policy, it's not necessarily a good equity comparison. If anything, the late 60s are some of the closest equity comparisons because you went into that period with the Nifty 50, they call them, right? So the 50 stocks that you couldn't go wrong buying, they were things like Procter & Gamble and Disney and Coca-Cola and Xerox. And many of them, those companies went on to do absolutely phenomenal for 20, 30 years in terms of their fundamentals and earnings growth, but they did terribly for 15 years in terms of stock returns because they started the period at such high valuations. Right. And so, you know, I think that both the dot-com bubble as well as the late 60s are kind of instructive, I think, for where we are in terms of say, maybe forward equity performance on a real basis.
Yeah, great points. All right, Lynn, I've got about 1,000 more questions, but I don't want to get too deep into the weeds because I know you're going to be having this discussion with our good friend Eric Townsend next week on Macro Voices. So I'd really encourage everyone to tune into that because Lynn will go into these ideas in more detail. So for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
So I'm at lynnalden.com and I'm on Twitter at lynnaldencontact. And I'm part of the Rebel Capitalist Pro platform that you put together.
That's right. She is one of my business partners there, with good buddy Chris McIntosh. And I also want to point out that Miss Lynn Alden is going to be at Rebel Capitalist Live. She's going to be speaking there in Houston, January 7th through the 9th. So if you haven't gotten your ticket for that, what on earth are you doing? You got to get your ticket right away before we're sold out at capacity, and you can find those tickets at rebelcapitalistlive.com.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.